uncovers corporate lies, exposes political corruption, and has a clear vision of what America could become. Here's Tom Hartman.
And greetings, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you. Greetings, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Dr. Yaron Brook is going to be with us here in just a moment. Oh, there he is, in fact. Dr. Brook is with the Ayn Rand Institute, AYNRAND.org, one of the think tanks that I would say is had, shall we say, a very heavy influence over the years on objectivist thought, on ultimately on libertarian thought, and these days on conservative thought as well. You're sort of the wellspring from which all this comes, Yaron. Welcome back to the program.
Thanks for having me on.
Always great to have you here. Understand that you folks are looking at the situation in Iran and Syria and Saudi Arabia and whatnot, and suggesting that we should just, drop a nuclear bomb on Iran?
I think that's an option that needs to be considered. I don't think it's necessary, but it's definitely, we shouldn't rule anything out. I think they are the number one threat today to the United States, and they need to be dealt with. It needs to be addressed. They are developing nuclear weapons. We don't want to be in a situation where they drop one on us.
But Iran was, in Iran, you had a very, very strong pro-democracy movement back 3 years ago. In fact, on 9/11, they held a candlelight vigils in support of the United States on, the day after 9/11. The president of Iran was a pro-West Democrat, small d Democrat. The legislature was passing a lot of reforms. Many of them were getting shot down by the Supreme Court, which was dominated by mullahs, but there was even talk about reforming that, although now Iraq is going to create the same kind of Supreme Court system that Iran has, apparently, with this new constitution. But, they were moving in our direction quite quickly. They were getting very westernized, a very modern state. They were kind of recovering from the period after the overthrow of the Shah. And then George Bush started all his belligerent talk about they're part of the axis of evil and everything, and the Iranian people started rallying around the hardliners. And now in the elections in June, we have a new president, or they have a new president in Iran, who is very anti-American and is very hardline. Aren't we creating a self-fulfilling prophecy by characterizing them as warlike, and then when they get that way, saying, okay, now let's get them?
Well, absolutely not. I mean, I'm no fan of the Bush administration. I think they've handled Iraq awfully, really, really badly, primarily by being too soft on them. No, I think your characterization of what was going on in Iran 3 years ago is just plain wrong. Khatami, who was the president at the time, was no pro-Western. He was definitely not pro-American. He was certainly not a small-D Democrat. He was he was an autocrat. So he was a little bit milder and a little bit less extreme than some of the people there. But nevertheless, he was an autocrat, and in his speeches, he was vehemently anti-American, anti-Israeli, threatening America all the time, threatening Israel all the time. And on top of that, this is the guy who is the moderate. He had almost no power within Iran. That is, the whole system there was geared around what's called the supreme leader, not the president, around these Supreme Court-type institutions. I wouldn't even call it a court. It's just a council of mullahs that really run the country, determine who will be elected, who will be, part of the administration. And, as a consequence, I think that Iran was the real enemy. It has been the real enemy since 1979, since they took the hostages in our embassy. They are the only country other than Afghanistan when the Taliban ruled it, that was ruled by the ideology of bin Laden, by totalitarian Islam, by this radicalized view of Islam that wants to destroy the West and wants to take over the Middle East to establish a caliphate.
Well, let's assume for a moment, Yaron Brook, that everything you're saying is right, and that there is, although I still will disagree with you on some of these points, but nonetheless, let's just assume for a moment that everything you're saying is right.
Yep.
How does dropping a nuke on these guys, or for that matter, how does dropping a nuke on Iraq and killing hundreds of thousands, perhaps millions of civilians, how does that help us in any way?
Well, again, I have not advocating dropping nukes on anybody, but I think that these regimes need to be crushed. These countries and cultures and ideologies need to be crushed just as we crushed the Japanese and just as we crushed the Germans. And how does that help us? It forces them to rethink the culture they belong to. It forces them to rethink their attitude towards the United States, just as the Japanese rethought it. And
but Aaron, with the Japanese...
Are America's friends.
With the Japanese and the Germans, though, they had both gone into what was historically an aberration. I mean, you had personality cults that had taken over both countries. They literally were cults.
That's just historically wrong. I mean, Germany was involved in World War II in which tens of millions of people died. Nazis...
As a result of the cult of the Nazis.
No, World War I had nothing to do with the cult of the Nazis. World War I was German militarism, and it had to do with the same, philosophy that was driving Germany towards the Nazis.
So we tried to crush militant Islam in the 11th century, or in the 12th century, in the 1100s with the Crusades.
We did. Well, of course, we failed because the Crusades were not won. But, you know, those Crusades were, I don't know the history of that era that well, but those Crusades could be interpreted as Christian aggression. I'm not for the West initiating force against the Middle East. I am claiming that that militant Islam in the Middle East has declared war against the United States. And we, if we intend to survive, then we need to take this war seriously and confront it, just like we confronted World War II.
I got it. Yaron Brook, this report just out of Saudi Arabia, hundreds of Saudi fighters who joined the insurgency in Iraq show few signs of militancy before the U.S.-led overthrow of Saddam Hussein. The study by the Washington-based Center for Strategic and International Studies obtained by Reuters on Sunday said Saudis made up just 350 of the 3,000-strong foreign insurgents in Iraq, but they go on to point out that most were motivated, quote, by revulsion at the idea of an Arab land being occupied by a non-Arab country, end quote. There are 2 billion Muslims in the world, more or less. This is the dominant religion in this region. They clearly see this as a war of religions and of civilizations and cultures. And it just seems to me like your suggestion that we have to crush militarily an idea is going to make the situation a whole lot worse. You're going to see Indonesia explode. You're going to see Pakistan explode. You're going to see Muslim communities all over the world rising up in arms against us, as if they aren't already. But, I mean, we're already seeing the leading edge of this. Your suggestion is just going to make things worse.
If the United States had said, look, the tens of millions of Germans, the Nazis all over the place, let's just compromise with them. Let's talk to them.
No, they were aggressive. The Nazis had attacked Austria, they attacked Poland. Iran has not attacked anybody.
And September 11th has not happened.
September 11th was not initiated by Iran.
The Iranians are now responsible for the Khobar Towers. They're now responsible for the Marine Barracks in Beirut in 1983. The Iranians have been killing Americans for 25 years. And it's time that we confronted that situation.
These were not state-to-state acts, Yaron. These were the acts of a criminal gang.
Read the intelligence reports. It was the Iranian military intelligence responsible for the Khobar Towers, and it was Iranian military intelligence responsible for the...
Well, then why is it that the Pakistani intelligence, ISI, sent $100,000 to Mohammed Atta a week before the 9/11 occurred? Do you think we should drop a nuke on Pakistan, too?
I think Pakistan needs to be dealt with, and I'm hoping that we can convince, over time, Musharraf to do what is necessary. I don't think he's doing anything close to what is necessary in order to eliminate...
So he needs to be dropping nukes on his own people over there in the western provinces where Osama is.
You're trying to make this out to be ridiculous, which it isn't. The point is this. You've got an enemy, it's militant Islam. What you got to do is go and look which countries support, finance, militant Islam. Iran, until a few years ago, had a line item in its budget called terrorism. Countries that have a line item in their budgets that finance Islamic terrorism need to be dealt with, and they need to be dealt with militarily because there's nobody to talk to over there, at least in the leadership. Now, if the Iranian people are truly pro-small-d democracy, if they truly want freedom, then they will rally for the United States. But let me get to a point you made earlier. The fact is that recruitment to militant Islam is on the rise throughout the Muslim world because America has shown nothing but weakness and appeasement. Its war in Iraq is a ridiculous attempt at warfare. And as a consequence, they are now convinced more than ever before that they can beat us, until we convince them that they cannot beat us, that we will, that they have no chance of victory, recruitment will continue to increase. And the more we appease them, the greater recruitment will be.
So war is the solution.
But this particular problem, unfortunately, yes.
Okay, Yaron Brook, the Ayn Rand Institute, AYNRAND.org. Yaron, thanks again for being with us.
Always a pleasure, Tom.
Always great to have you here. Thank you. 17 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Hartman.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
If you're out of a job and your pension's been robbed, well, it's no act of God. You've been bushwhacked. And if you work 40 plus, but you're still going bust because your rent's going up, you've been bushwhacked. You've been bushwhacked, Jack, in a natural fact.
And welcome back, my friends. This is bumper music by GeorgeandJulius.com, the website. The CD, Hail to the Thief 2, Songs to Send Bush Packing, GeorgeandJulius.com. Bushwhacked. Welcome back. You know why it's, I said to Yaron Brook, it's great to have you on the program. It really is, because it gives us an insight into the thinking behind the whole conservative mindset. And I think it's really important that we understand that. That, frankly, I think it's a very dangerous way of thinking. I don't agree with it, but this is America. We respect everybody's right to their opinion. And I just think it's important that these issues be brought out. Bob, and is it Portola, California, Bob?
Yeah, that's right.
Hey, Bob, welcome to the program.
Thanks. Hey, I was stunned listening to this morning. It's amazing to get inside the mind of someone like that, to truly understand that the absolutely amoral depths, to them, it's all a... So we nuke a million people, five of whom might have some connection to some threat against the U.S. We're going to have the entire world despise us, and rightfully so. We become Hitler for nuking a population that has done nothing to us, that hasn't declared war upon us. At a time of peace, we just say, you know what, you're harboring terrorists, boom.
Yeah.
I mean... It's just...
It's breathtaking,
nice,
isn't it?
America. Yeah, it's just stunning.
It's
oh, God. And secondly, it's like, the other part, though, he missed Vietnam entirely, which is also Iraq. Gwyneth Dyer wrote a really good book called War, which is based on the old PBS series from the mid-'80s.
Right.
And he had a great point in there, which is, democracies do not have the political will to sustain a long-term invasion against a guerrilla force.
Right.
We don't want to see the bodies coming home. I'm not sacrificing my children, 17, 15, and 12, to girls and a boy.
Yeah.
I refuse to sacrifice my children to all these crazy jackasses.
And in fact, that's a variation on the whole concept that no two democracies, true democracies, have ever gone to war in history. And the reason why, with each other. And the reason why is because people in a democracy will not vote or will not support an aggressive action that is not necessary. And that's why you're seeing Bush's, poll numbers in the toilet. He thinks he can pull it out by putting lipstick on that pig, of his war and all this stuff. But it ain't going to work because the people of America are just saying enough with the body bags. We're not up for this. We don't want this. This is not the kind of people we are. This is not what we're all about. Bob, thank you for the call. It's a good point that you make. Jason in Grand Rapids. Hey, Jason.
Yeah, hey. Just real quick, wanted to kind of pull some cover off of this war against ideology or war against Islam. Now, on the one hand, they go and promote the cons, the right wing. They promote war and, totalitarianism and repression in these Muslim countries. But
yeah,
then,
we prop up these dictators.
Right. And then when it exports to other countries and the people resist, then all of a sudden, we have to do something about it. We have to rein these countries in that are out of control. But it's not – I heard someone – I think it was on your show – that said that the Taliban was actually the Mujahideen, you know, back in the 80s.
Oh, sure. We funded it. We sponsored it in Afghanistan to try and bring down the Soviet Union, to throw the Soviets out of Afghanistan. And, in fact, one of the reasons, most historians agree now, one of the many reasons, but one of the things that led to the fall of the Soviet Union at the time that it fell, I mean, it was inevitably heading down that road because their economic and political system simply didn't work. But one of the reasons why they fell when they did was because they've been bled dry in part by Afghanistan. And that was supported by us. We were supporting Osama bin Laden. We helped put together the Mujahideen. We were aggressively supporting that. We were supporting it through Saudi Arabia and directly. And, you know, the CIA operation there. And Osama bin Laden was, you know, one of our guys, just like the Shah of Iran. We put the Shah of Iran into place, and he ran this brutal dictatorship. And when the people finally said, enough already, we're tired of the brutal dictator, then, you know, we got to deal with that. We've got to deal with that rage. And I really think that following failed policies with more failed policies and with nuclear weapons is just not the way to go, or any kind of, you know, bomb them back to the Stone Age mentality. Jason, thank you for your point. I remember one time I was, Dick Gregory and I were flying over to Africa. This was in 1980. As I recall, maybe 81, and we were over the Atlantic in the middle of the night, all jazzed up, wide awake, on our second glass of wine, and he made this point that has stuck with me to this day. We were going over to Uganda, whole long story, but anyway, he says, Dick Gregory, the black comedian, and he says, he was on our board of directors for this charity that I was working with, and he says, you know what I don't understand? He says, I don't understand why America's all the time trying to run around the world, shoving our way of life down other people's throats with the barrel of a gun. He says, when you've got something good, you don't have to force it on people. They will steal it. And it is just so true that if we provided a good example to the world, and if we supported those democracies that are aggressively democratic as opposed to simply aggressive, and we're the world's good citizen, you'd have countries all over the world saying, we want to be like them. Instead, you got countries all over the world going, we want to be like Sweden. You know, what's wrong with this picture? I think it's possible for America to be a great moral leader and be a great nation and you know, economically great, politically great, militarily great, without having to bomb every country that speaks ill of us back to the Stone Age. In fact, we can bring them into democracy. 27 minutes past the hour.
Democracy to the United States of America. Here's Tom Hartman.
Let me introduce myself. George W. is my name. And I'm a rich, dumb, frat ball goof, and all has been my game. My daddy's name and money help me everywhere I go. And I want to be your leader, though my brain's a little slow. I'm George W.
And welcome back, my friends. 34 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Our program brought to you today by Small Dog Electronics, 1-800-511-MAX, 1-800-511-MACS, and the Organic Wine Company, Eco Wine, ecowine.com on the web, 1-888-ECO-WINE, E-C-O-W-I-N-E, 1-888-ECO-WINE for some for an extraordinary drinking experience, which sometimes you need after listening to George W. go on and on for a while. He's just wrapping up. He just finished a speech. In fact, this is the Marine Band, I believe. Yeah. Anyhow, so he was just blithering on just a moment ago. Anyway, welcome back to our program. In the second hour of our program, we're going to have Clint Curtis on. He's going to be talking about what happens when you privatize an election process. That'll be in the third hour of our program. The second hour of the program, we're going to be talking with Alec Dubrow, of the International Labor Communications Association. Going to get into issues about the Bush administration, their spin machine with regard to Clinton. Who is at fault with Katrina? Is it Blanken, Nagin, Bush, or FEMA? We have a new answer, a new retort. This is really interesting, a little insight into why those buses that were in those photos for weeks on the Drudge Report, on the front page of Drudge, and that the right-wingers were just banging away at, you know, why are these buses that are underwater, why were they not used? Well, I'll just tell you right now. It turns out Kathleen Blanco did an interview yesterday, and she said that she offered, they were going to use those school buses to get people out. And she had a conversation with the FEMA folks, and they said, don't use them. They're not air-conditioned. And that they were sending buses down. And the buses never came. So, there you have it. 1-866-889-8894. Telephone number, Karen in Federal Way, Washington. Hey, Karen.
Hey, Tom. I just wanted to comment on that fellow from Ayn Rand. Is that how you pronounce it?
Ayn Rand.
Ayn Rand. Okay. Yes. Ironically, Ayn. Okay. I just wonder why he never thought to mention Saudi Arabia.
Well, I suspect he would have been perfectly willing to discuss Saudi Arabia. I think Yaron Brook is an equal opportunity bomber.
Oh, okay.
In fact, in the news release that we had from him, or the article that he wrote that originally got me thinking, you know, we ought to have him on to talk about this.
Mm-hmm.
He writes, and I quote, the terrorists fighting for Islamic totalitarianism were and are made possible by the dictatorial regimes, including Iran, Syria, and Saudi Arabia, that support them. He said, at the very least, we must eliminate the biggest sponsor of Islamic totalitarianism, Iran. He goes into a rant about that.
Right.
But he named Saudi Arabia right up front.
He named them, but yeah. I'm a tad bit more worried about Saudi Arabia at this moment, not to mention Pakistan.
Yeah, Pakistan, to me, is the wild card that could throw the whole world. Pakistan, right now, in my mind, is Archduke Ferdinand.
You know,
for those who don't remember, none of us remember probably who are alive today, but those who don't remember the history of it, Archduke Ferdinand was the Count of Sarajevo or whatever, the Duke of, it was in Sarajevo, actually. He was from the Austro-Hungarian Empire, wasn't he? I think he was, part of the House of Habsburg, but in any case, he was assassinated in Sarajevo by a Serb, and that's what started World War I.
Mm-hmm.
And to this day, nobody can explain what World War I was about, other than the fact that, Country A had a treaty with Country B that said if Country A was attacked, Country B had to come to their defense, and Country C had a treaty with Country D, and so Country A gets attacked by Country C, and that means Country B has to come into Country A's defense, which means Country D has to come into its country, and pretty soon you got a world war. And that's why Woodrow Wilson was so hyperactive about creating the League of Nations, which became ultimately the United Nations, to prevent another world war from happening.
And we're trying to shoot that down at the moment.
Well, yeah, and we were not in the League of Nations, by the way, leading up to World War II, because the Republicans fought Woodrow Wilson every single step of the way on that thing. And after World War II, finally the Republicans looked around and said, okay, maybe this League of Nations idea, maybe having world wars every 30 years isn't such a good plan. And we had the United Nations, although there's still a lot of Republicans who think that the United Nations is a bad idea. Anyway, yes,
a footnote to the Afghanistan Soviet Union.
Yeah.
Have you read Charlie Wilson's War?
No, I have not.
I recommend it. It's a funny but horribly tragic read.
This is a book?
It's a book by George Crile. It's probably still in print, or you can get it used. And I understand that Tom Hanks is thinking about making a movie about it, coming out in 2007.
And in a sentence, what's the point of the book?
Charlie Wilson is a crazy Democrat from Texas who ran circles around Ronald Reagan to fund the Taliban and Osama bin Laden in Afghanistan to run out the Soviet Union, and he really did a lot of kind of questionable stuff, and by God, he pulled it off.
Yeah, for better or for worse, ultimately.
Yeah, and it was a Democrat, and Reagan didn't really want to do it. But he was tricked into it.
Interesting.
Okay, thanks.
It's interesting
Bye.
How, kind of what goes around comes around. Thanks a lot, Karen. Good
Bye
to hear, good to hear from you. Doug in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Hey, Doug, welcome to the program.
Hey, thanks for having me on.
Sure.
Let me start my speech with, I'm an agnostic, so I don't really have any real strong beliefs either way. But it seems
in other words, you don't have a dog in the fight of religious wars?
That's right. But it seems since Bush has started this crusade that, the weather has gotten worse and, the hurricanes are coming and there's more natural disasters and everything in our country has been going the wrong way, whether he had anything to do with it or not. So, the crusade that he started, maybe the God that we should be praising isn't a Christian God.
Well,
and what we should do is take a page out of history from our ancestors, and we should take Bush up to Mount St. Helens and sacrifice him to bring things back to order.
Yeah, well, or maybe just give him a good shaking. I don't think either one of us want to advocate on the radio anything that would lead to the death of the president. But
I
realize you're being facetious. I realize you're being facetious. But the point is that I think. Yeah, there are probably out there. I mean, if Pat Robertson can say that all this stuff is proof that God is on our side, that God allowed 9/11 to happen, that the Katrina was a gift from God to John Roberts for his nomination, then I suppose you could argue from the other side, the other also Christian side, that God's trying to get our attention, and maybe what he's trying to say, if that's the case, is, hey guys, wake up! You've got the wrong people running your country. I mean, look back in the Old Testament, how things didn't go right. People said, maybe we should reconsider. Maybe we should reconsider our leadership. Maybe we should reconsider the road we're traveling down. Theologically, I just don't see this as a theological issue. I see it just as a plain old political issue. Jay in Atlanta on the line. Hey, Jay, welcome to the program.
West Wing's replay. Alan Alda's Republican character made a great point about this. He said, if you want me to, and the rest of the politicians, to tell you what our religious beliefs are, you're most likely going to get us lying to you, so just back off.
Yeah.
But my bigger point for calling is two things. I heard Mike Malloy say recently that Bush actually said not too long ago that we went to Iraq to protect the oil fields.
Yeah, he said it in a news conference about a week and a half, 2 weeks ago.
Okay, and
he didn't say that was the only reason, but he said that was a reason why we had to be there.
All right, and another thing is, you saw the Hitchens debate with Galloway?
I did.
Remember when Amy asked Hitchens about the weapons of mass destruction not being the primary reason we went, and his answer?
Broadly, my recollection is that his answer was the same answer that you're getting these days out of most of the cons, which is, well, that was one of many reasons.
No, well, I mean, his answer, along with that, basically was saying in so many words that there was specific evidence that there was a connection and that Bush or any leader would not be doing us a favor if he gave them the benefit of the doubt. I mean, he seemed like he actually had some specific history or connections to, and I would love for someone like you to be able to go over the specific details he brought up so we could debunk it if it's accurate.
Well, the problem is there's nothing there to debunk. The fact of the matter is that Mohammed al-Baradei had been, poking around Iraq for some considerable period of time, and the UN nuclear weapons inspector looking for the possibility of any nuclear programs going on. The one thing that cons throw out at me, Lars Larson just sent me an email about this the other day. He said, there was all that yellow cake there, that uranium, it's in Iran, or in Iraq, rather, that Saddam had. And I was like, yeah, he acquired that back when he was our friend. We helped him acquire it. And it had been under United Nations seal up until the time that we invaded. And then people looted it. And as far as we can tell, it wasn't even looted by people who knew that they were taking uranium. It was local people who wanted to use the barrels as water containers, to catch rainwater and things, because the local water supply had fallen apart as a result of our bombing. And so they're drinking this uranium-contaminated water. But, that's the thing that they usually toss out is, well, he had a little bit of yellow cake there in the country. And, yeah, it had been sitting there for a decade, and it takes a lot more than yellow cake to make a bomb. And if a country having yellow cake is a good reason to drop, hundreds of thousands of weapons on them, then we've got a list of about 25, 30 countries that we should be starting to attack, next week. So
how many countries have a good reason to attack us,
Yeah, well, there is that, too. It's to what extent the rest of the world is beginning to view us as a rogue state is I think for all Americans should be a major concern, and not just the radicalized world, not just the world that we've attacked, but the rest of the so-called Western world, the industrialized world, and the Eastern world. That Japan and China and our historic ally South Korea. The point that they're starting to look at us and go, whoa. 45 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
I don't want to be a soldier. I don't want to kill and maim another mother's son or daughter. Imperial war is a dirty game.
That's Julius of georgeandjulius.com. Julius is 89 years old and been a union activist in New York City for most of those 89 years. Still is, in fact, the oldest delegate to his union in that city, georgeandjulius.com. Welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you. 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number. Here on the True People's Radio, the place where smart people get their news. Tony in Grand Rapids, Michigan on the line. Hey, Tony, what's up?
Hi, Tom. I just have to say about the nuking Iran thing. As long as if we're going to nuke Iran, why don't we start nuking major U.S. cities to get rid of the organized crime syndicate and street gangs?
Yeah, there's a plan for you.
Yeah, it's about the same
in
thing.
In fact, there's, you know, with all the evidence out there that John Kennedy was actually killed by Carlos Marcello and Santos Traficante by the mob. You know, John Davis, his book Mafia Kingfish, lays out a lot of that very well. Yeah, maybe we should just nuke them. Yeah. No, it's you're right. I mean, this is the whole point. From the very beginning, the whole idea of declaring a war on terrorism, if George W. Bush had done against Osama bin Laden the exact same thing that Bill Clinton did against Tim McVeigh, which is mobilize the police forces of the world. I mean, we had Interpol looking for McVeigh and his associates. We had no idea where he was initially. He could have been anywhere. Mobilize the police forces of the world, bring these guys to justice, treat them as criminals, make them pariahs in their own communities. You know, awaken everybody to the fact that they're just thugs. They're killers.
And McVeigh was caught, captured, tried, and killed.
Exactly. And people had closure. The victims of the Oklahoma City bombing were able to say, okay, that's it. You know, it's over. And thank goodness we got it. Tony, thanks a lot for the call. I appreciate
it.
Dave in Georgia, truck driver on the road. Hey, Dave.
Good morning, Tom. How are you this morning?
I am great, but I'll get better, Dave. What's up?
Yeah, I caught in the truck lounge this morning the Tony Danza show, and he had Kathleen Cryer on with her new book, Contempt. And I was wondering if you knew about it and what your thoughts were on it. She was tearing the religious right a new rear end. She's a former judge out of Texas who is on Court TV now, and she was talking about the Jefferson Bible and how Thomas Jefferson and the early founders of the United States believed in the ethics of Jesus and basic humanity, but not necessarily the points from the Christian right.
Yeah, well, in fact, Thomas Jefferson went through the New Testament, or at least the first four books, the first four Gospels, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, and took out all the miracles. And because he viewed Jesus as a philosopher, not as a Greek god, the way that Jefferson believed that Paul had essentially reinvented Jesus. And so he de-reinvented Jesus back to being a philosopher. And that's the Jefferson Bible. And it's been continuously in print, by the way, since about 1815 or so. And you can still buy it. So.
Yeah. Well, I was just, she was doing this, and I didn't catch the full show. And I thought maybe you had read it or heard about it.
No, I've
comment on it.
Yeah, I can't. I'm sorry. I've seen her on TV. I know who she is, but beyond that, I don't know, Dave. But
well, you might want to do a review of the book and let your readers know what it's about.
Yeah, I'll check it out. I'll check it out. Dave, thanks a lot. Good to hear from you. And Diane in Grand Rapids, Michigan, on the line. WTKG. Hey, Diane, what's up?
Hi. On the theme of how badly the world looks at us.
Mm-hmm.
And it's starting to look at us worse and worse. I was at the Arctic Wildlife Refuge, Save the Arctic Wildlife Refuge Day of Action in Washington yesterday, and there were some Canadians there. And the world is starting to look at us drilling in the Arctic Wildlife Refuge the same way we looked at the Taliban blowing up those statues of the
Buddha.
The Buddha, right? It took them, it took them weeks and weeks to blow up that, and that was a world treasure.
Yeah.
And that's how the world looks at us, you know, proposing to drill in the Arctic Wildlife Range. This is a world treasure, and we're just going to toss it away.
Yeah, among other things that we're tossing away. I mean,
yes.
The privatization of our national parks, Bush unprotecting literally tens of million, I think it was 54 million acres, some mind-boggling number of acres of wild lands in the United States.
Yeah.
Here in the Pacific Northwest, they just, a whole series of rivers and streams that were under protection to protect native fish species, they just took them out of that protection and said, hey, you're on your own now. Don't worry, the developers will work it out with you. And the developers, you know, we're going to leave it to the free market because the developers are going to realize that when they build all those McMansions along the rivers that, you know, those people are going to want there to be fish in the stream. And so they'll do something. Don't worry. And it's nuts.
Right. It's nuts. And people are worrying. The Canadians were there at the rally saying, what are you doing? This is our, these are our caribou herds, too.
Yeah. Yeah. It's crazy. Diane, thanks for the call. Dennis in Mattoon, Illinois on the line. Hey, Dennis.
Hey, how you doing, Tom?
Great. What's
up? You know,
up?
My point is, and you got a caller earlier about, what, you know, you talked about what Clinton did with McVeigh. Well, Clinton did the same thing with the first World Trade Center bombers.
That's right. And they're in jail now.
And, you know, and the Republicans are great to quote Robert Maxwell, Justice Robert Maxwell, about the Constitution is not a suicide pact. And Robert Maxwell, I think they quote him to their advantage, but if you look at the history of Judge Maxwell, he set up the Nuremberg tribunals.
Mm-hmm.
That tried the Nazis in a fair construct.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
said, hey, we have evidence. They did it.
Yeah.
You know, and we meted out sentence, and we found some people innocent, so forth.
Yeah. There are many people around the world, tragically for the United States, there are many people around the world who are suggesting that perhaps members of this administration should be brought before the world court. And in fact, there, you know, Germany charges have been filed against George Bush and Don Rumsfeld for and Dick Cheney for war crimes. The Republicans in this administration, and it is an embarrassing thing. We must change our administration, and we all have an opportunity to do that coming up in about 12, 13 months, and shorter than that. Get involved in the primaries. So get out there, get registered to vote, and start showing up.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. For a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded, here's Tom Hartman.
And every time Rush Limbaugh hears that theme music, he ups his meds. Welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you, the program where reason and passion go together. It was like Republican presidents and gay hookers. And I guess the Jeff Gannon story is getting a little old, isn't it? Anyhow, welcome back. Alec Dubrow is with us with the International Labor Communications Association, ilcaonline.org, the website. And Alec, you were pointing out to me this website, Working for Justice in the Global Economy, the International Labor Rights Fund, which
exactly.
I have to confess I was unaware of. Tell me about the ILRF. It's laborrights.org is their website for those who want to check it out.
That's right. Labor Rights with two R's, laborrights.org. Fascinating organization. Fascinating in their purpose and their dedication. Also fascinating in what they've managed to achieve. They're a small group here in Washington. They're
Washington, D.C.
Washington, D.C., that's right. I should specify that. And they are largely, they're funded by foundations primarily and individual donors. They have had some church support as well. They take action on the most egregious and the worst labor violations in the world. I think that's how they decided to go about it. And much of what they've done, but certainly by no means all, has been directed at child labor and slave labor. You know, we have it tough here, but there are people who have it tougher. And they started in 1986, and they've done a number of campaigns. They began with something called Global March Against Child Labor. They went on to a couple of campaigns that got pretty high visibility and effectiveness. One was called Foul Ball. and it raised public awareness over use of child labor in a production of soccer balls. Now, soccer balls are used all over the world. Everybody knows what they are. And they're produced, one of the countries in which they were produced in great numbers was Pakistan. And they found out that many of these used children, boys specifically, to produce them. These were boys who were of school age, and I believe Pakistan has a law requiring children to be in school, and it wasn't enforced, and they were worked under very difficult and painful conditions. So they did this foul ball campaign in which soccer balls produced without child labor were given an imprimatur, a mark saying, these are good, the others are bad.
Right.
They moved on to something that was even better known called rug mark, because in the same part of the world, largely the Middle East, children create carpets. And the ILRF created this thing called rug mark, an innovative program, which moved the children from the looms to school and created an international governance. And the program, the ILRF says, has certified over 2 million child labor-free carpets. Now, this is very good, and I know a number of people out there are saying, you know, that's fabulous, but what does this necessarily have to do for American workers? And in truth, what the ILRF does, and other groups are trying to do at this point, is show the linkage between extreme exploitation overseas and how that affects us here. I mean,
and how does that affect us here, Eric?
Well, in one sense, that's great. We get our goods cheaper, and that means I don't have to work as much. But at the same time, what this does is create a downward pressure on wages. And
domestically, here in the United States.
Here in the United States. And
because now if somebody wants to make soccer balls, they can make them in Pakistan for pennies on the dollar. Yeah.
Pennies on the dollar. And if that's not cheap enough, well, they'll get kids to do it and not even bother to pay them.
Right.
So the
argument that is made by these guys constantly of, oh, well, you wouldn't want to have to pay 20% more for everything in Walmart like you would have to if everything was made in the United States, would you? The simple rebuttal to that is I would have no problem paying 20% more for everything in Walmart if my paycheck was 40% higher.
Exactly. And they've done exactly that in the last week. The ILRF went to court in California and sued Walmart on the behalf of two basic groups. One were the factories producing goods directly under contract to Walmart, and they did it on four continents, in Africa, Latin America, South Asia, and East Asia. Well, I guess that's not four, but three continents, Indonesia, Bangladesh, China, Nicaragua, Swaziland, saying that workers there working under Walmart contracts, subcontracts, were denied basic minimum wage, forced to work overtime whether they wanted to or not, and in many cases denied the right to organize, which was essential because the government doesn't protect them. Their need for a union is important. At the same time, there's another class of plaintiffs will be employees of California businesses which, quote, have been harmed by Walmart's unfair labor practices. Within this class are trade union members who were forced to make wage and benefit concessions to allow their employers to try to compete with Walmart. So, in other words, you're an industrial worker, a service worker, and your employer says, I guess you're not going to get a raise this year. In fact, we're going to have to cut your wages because Walmart is undercutting us. Well, this is part of...
Yeah, it all echoes back at home. Now, we see today that Hamid Karzai, the former Unocal executive,
yes,
who is now president of Afghanistan, has said, just in the last 24 hours, has said that the United States should stop bombing Afghanistan. Thank you very much. We don't need any more bombs. And that we should stop doing house-to-house searches. He doesn't want us busting into people's houses anymore. Apparently the blowback is a little more than they can handle. And this raises the issue of UNICAL in general. Apparently this group that you're talking about, the internet.
The ILR, yeah.
Yeah. They have taken on UNICAL on slave labor in Burma. Tell us about that very quickly.
Well, the good news is they took them on in 1996, and this year they won.
So it only took them 9 years?
Yeah, that's how long it takes a case to wind through the courts. But you know, in spite of a number of rulings that had gone against them, they continued to fight it in the California courts. And they took on UNICAL on the basis of it was a U.S.-based company that was knowingly using slave labor. And that thousands of villagers had been forced to work at gunpoint on the UNICAL pipeline. They filed a second case on behalf of a second group of villagers who managed to survive, and some of them managed to get out of Burma, which is, you know, is a strict military government, and pass the information on. Anyway,
this is one of the things that boggles my mind, Alec. Is how can we maintain, you know, why isn't Burma on our list of evil countries when they are arguably one of the most, probably one of the five most repressive regimes in the world? Is it simply because so many American companies have factories there?
One would think. You know, we've always been extremely selective as to who we call a repressive government and who we call a valued friend.
Yeah,
we do. We give lip service to Burma's lack of democracy, but we don't take sanctions against them. I don't know. You know, I don't know exactly how this process works, and I'd be glad to look into it. But the truth of the matter is, Burma is far more repressive than countries such as Venezuela, who are gunning for openly.
Yeah. Well, this is an organization that's worth checking out, worth knowing about, worth spending some time on their website, Labor Rights, with two R's, LaborRights.org.
Right.
And thanks for sharing that with us, Alec. It's much appreciated. Alec DeBro is with the International Labor Communications Association, which is ilcaonline.org. We have about a half a minute, Alec. Anything hot happening on your website?
Yes. We're going to redo our website.
Okay.
More stories. You know, it's a terrible thing in some ways, but it's a good thing. People are known. Organizations are known by their website.
So you're becoming more of a central clearinghouse for labor stories and labor news.
Exactly. That's just what we're doing. In fact, we're going to be reaching out, grabbing stories, and not waiting for people to submit them, and having a full scope of labor stories.
So, sounds great. Okay.
Let's keep looking.
There you go. Alec DeBro, International Labor Communications Association, ilcaonline.org. Thanks, Alec, for being with us today.
Talk to you next week.
Indeed.
Bye-bye.
It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program. The pill that will help you escape the matrix. 16 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Folks in Florida cast their votes, as all good citizens do. In West Palm Beach, the ballot read to vote for one, punch two. Once you punched it, punch it again, give it another good push. You thought you voted for Gore, surprise, you cast your ballot for Bush.
Hey. And welcome back to the radio support group of, by, and for We the People. Tom Hartman here with you. Hunger strike spreads at Guantanamo Camp. This from Interpress Service, this a tragic story, another example of the misguided policies, destructive to the reputation of the United States of America, harmful to our nation, of the Bush administration and the Republicans, and the Democrats that enabled them, like Joe Lieberman. This is just, the whole new Democrat DLC bunch of them. This is just such a tragic example of the insanity of standing up and saying, we are a great democracy, we believe in democratic principles, we believe in the Bill of Rights, but by the way, We're going to lock people up without access to a court, without charging them with a crime, without letting them see a lawyer. We're going to handcuff them. We're going to put hoods over their heads. We're going to tie them to the floor for days at a time where they're going to have to sleep in their own urine and feces. But by the way, we're the greatest democracy in the world. There's a dissonance between those two messages that is not going unnoticed by the rest of the world. And who could have imagined that people who may well be enemies of the United States, we won't know until somebody's charged with a crime and tried in a court of law, people who may well be enemies hold the high moral ground in the eyes of the world. This from Interpress Service, a hunger strike started in June. It is now September. A hunger strike started in June, in fact, it's September 21st, by terror suspects imprisoned by the U.S. military at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, and reportedly settled, has been restarted and is growing, with 15 detainees hospitalized, 13 being fed through tubes. The number of hunger strikers varies. The military has said at various times the number is 89 and 76. But a lawyer for a group of detainees says the number is now 200 and growing. After the first hunger strike, the United States said that they would bring the prison. Now, see, in my mind, I don't think we should be using the word prison. Guantanamo Bay isn't a prison. Prisons are for people who have been convicted of crimes. These people have not held, they have not been convicted of a crime. They've not even been charged with crimes. This is a concentration camp, or these are. There's five of them down there. These are concentration camps. Anyhow, we said we would bring them into compliance with the Geneva Convention. One of the folks in our concentration camp said, as a result of these promises, we agreed to end the strike on July 28th. It is now August 11th. They have betrayed our trust again. Lawyer Stafford Smith says, these people are desperate. They've been there 3 years. They were promised that the Geneva Conventions would be respected and various charges would happen, and unfortunately, the U.S. government reneged on that. We're not even charging them with crimes. And now you have John Roberts coming along and saying, in this decision about 3 weeks ago, yeah, that's just fine. Just fine. Rights under the Constitution? I don't think so. John Kerry, by the way, just came out and said he would be voting against the confirmation of John Roberts. You just have to ask yourself, after Ruth Bader Ginsburg actually honestly and openly answered questions about things like her stance on abortion, her stance on personal rights, her stance on privacy, her stance on whether the government had the right to detain people without trial, just a whole spectrum of things. When virtually all of the Supreme Court nominees, with the arguable exception of Clarence Thomas, were pretty forthcoming in who they were and what they were all about. And Roberts comes along and basically just does this, you know, just soft shoe. I mean, just the whole shuffle. You know, he's not gonna tell us where he's at, what he's gonna say, how he's gonna rule. He's just plain old flat out not going to tell us.
I'm not going to comment. I can't address that. I feel the need to stay away from a discussion I don't remember. I do not feel it appropriate for me to comment. I don't want to discuss anything. I can't answer that. I don't know what it's a matter
of. So now in the midst of this, John Kerry has said, enough already. I can't vote for this guy because, you know, the Bush administration is refusing to give us the papers on him.
Issues like that. I don't want to answer. I can't comment. I don't.
And he won't give us straight answers.
I can't answer. I'm not going to comment. I'm not.
And so I can't vote for this guy.
I'm not supposed to comment publicly in any way. I shouldn't be expressing.
And Harry Reid has said the same thing, the head of the Senate Democrats.
It's inappropriate to comment.
The answers are misleading.
But they may be misleading, but they're his answers.
Okay. I have to maintain some silence.
Yeah. So good on you, John Kerry. Good on you, Harry Reid. And I have heard that Pat Leahy says he's going to vote for him. I'm finding that hard to believe. I'm trying to track it down. 27 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman radio program. Truth in Broadcasting for a change.
This is the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
I'm George W. Don't you cry for me. Now I've made it to the White House. That's in Washington, D.C.
That's
right.
And welcome back, my friends. 34 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Moving toward a bright and sparkling future by returning democracy to this great republic, the United States of America. If you only read the New York Times, you would tend to believe that British soldiers working undercover were arrested by Iraqi police, and that when the Iraqi police refused to turn them back over to the coalition forces, these soldiers were, to quote the New York Times, freed as a British armored vehicle blasted through the wall of their jail, end quote. Sounds good. Until you read The Independent, a British newspaper. Keep in mind, these were British troops, with reporters actually in Iraq. Here's what The Independent had to say about it. British troops were struggling to maintain control in Basra last night after the city exploded in bloody violence following the alleged killing of an Iraqi policeman by a British soldier. This is, can you spell powder keg? I mean, that's what we have here. Two British servicemen dressed in civilian clothes were held at Basra's main police station after the incident. It dressed in civilian clothes. Interesting. Outside, rioting began as the city threatened to descend into anarchy. Now, Basra is a city that was widely considered to be, calm and peaceful, safe place. But then it gets very curious. This again from The Independent. The British newspaper, major British national newspaper. Last night, British forces used up to 10 tanks supported by helicopters to smash through the walls of the jail and free the two British servicemen. John Reid, the defense secretary, later confirmed they were back with UK forces. Around 150 prisoners were said to have escaped during the assault. So the British busted two of their guys out of jail. And in the process, let 150 prisoners go free. Mohammed El-Wa'ili, the governor of the province in which Basra is located, condemned this assault on the jail as, quote, barbaric, savage, and irresponsible. And you have to wonder, are we approaching some horrible tipping point in Iraq? Or have we perhaps already passed it? Now over 1,900 American soldiers dead in Iraq. And for what noble cause? In his most recent press conference where the issue was raised, George W. Bush said it was for oil. I think the reason why he's now starting to fall back on this is because he doesn't want to discuss the real reason why he attacked Iraq, which Cindy Sheehan so eloquently pointed out. And she laid it right out, indisputably. It's about political capital. It's about George Bush getting reelected. It's about the Republicans taking back the Senate after they had been abandoned, as it were. I mean, this is what it's about. Cindy Sheehan. I think I have this queued up right.
As a matter of fact, in interviews in 1999 with respected journalist and longtime Bush family friend, Mickey Herskowitz.
Now, let me just point out, number one, Herskowitz was hired by the Bush family to write A Charge to Keep, which is George Bush's autobiography, which is in print now, number one. And number two, this is Cindy Sheehan testifying before John Conyers Commission.
Then Governor George Bush stated, "One of the keys to being seen as a great leader is to be seen as commander-in-chief. My father had all this political capital built up when he drove the Iraqis out of Kuwait, and he wasted it. If I have a chance to invade, if I had that much capital, I'm not going to waste it. I'm going to get everything passed that I want to get passed, and I'm going to have a successful presidency, end quote. It looks like George Bush is ready to lead this country into an avoidable war even before he became president. From the expose of the Downing Street memo and the conversations with George Bush from 1999, it seems like the invasion of Iraq and the deaths of so many innocent people were preordained. It appears that my boy Casey was given a death sentence even before he joined the Army in May of 2000.
There you go. It appears that my boy Casey was given a death sentence even before he joined the Army in May of 2000. And that, of course, before when Bill Clinton was still president. Amazing. Absolutely, tragically amazing. And then you've got, and then Bill Clinton comes out and says, you know, I don't think this is a good idea. You know, Bush never did demonstrate to the world or to us that there were actually weapons of mass destruction there. Should have let the inspectors finish their work. And Brit Hume and Fox News, they go absolutely ballistic. No sitting president has ever, you know, been contradicted by a previous president. No previous president. George Herbert Walker Bush would never do that. He would never. In fact, Brit Hume's charged on ABC's This Week. He said that President George Herbert Walker Bush did not do, and that is something, you know, that Clinton did something that President George Herbert Walker Bush did not do, and that is to criticize the sitting president and his administration. In other words, when Clinton became president and George Bush the senior was the ex-president, according to Brit Hume, the ex-president George Bush the senior never criticized Bill Clinton because that wouldn't be a noble thing to do. Except for the fact that on October 13th, 1993, Bush attacked Clinton for going into Somalia. He said, and I quote, the Clinton administration had messed up the humanitarian mission to Somalia. The quote is messed up. Here's the actual quote. Quote, if you're going to put, this is Elder President Bush speaking of then sitting President Clinton. Quote, if you're going to put somebody else's son or daughter into harm's way into battle, you've got to know the answer to three questions. How are they going to do it? How are they going to get out of there? And what is the mission? You can find it in the New York Times, October 14, 1993. In an interview published in February 1994, the Washingtonian magazine, George Bush the Elder criticized sitting President Bill Clinton for a, quote, purported lack of general strategy, end quote, in the foreign policy arena, and the, quote, stop and start failures, end quote, it had exhibited, pointing toward Bosnia and Haiti. March 8, 1994, Bush Sr. attacks Clinton over Haiti. On April 8, 1994, Bush Sr., speaking at Carl Albert State College in Oklahoma, attacks Clinton's health care proposals. On July 26, 1996, in a news conference with Bob Dole, the elder former President Bush, quote, criticized Clinton for boasting of current economic stability, according to the Kansas City Star article published the following day, saying, quote, he handed Clinton an economy that grew at 5% in 1993. That was not a recession. In other words, Bush Sr. taking responsibility for the Clinton economy. In 1996, several days later, campaigning with Bob Dole, Bush suggested that Clinton had compromised, quote, the integrity of the White House, end quote. In a letter released on April 23, 1998, former President Bush attacked then-President Bill Clinton, quote, criticized the White House and its allies for their continuing public policy to criticize independent counsel Kenneth Starr and undermine his investigation, end quote. Faux news at it again. 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number. Joe in Brookings, Oregon on the line. Hey, Joe.
Yeah, well, is it just me, but is it a fact that I don't think this story about the British knocking down that jail is getting nearly as much attention as it should be getting?
And not here in the United States. It is in the UK.
Yeah, well, as usual, you probably got to go to the BBC to get some real news. But I thought the whole idea of the British and the Americans going over there in the first place was to give, you know, the good people of Iraq to give them their country back, and that's why we're supposedly training their police forces there in Iraq, so they can get back on their feet and have their own country again. So what do the British do? What do the slimy limeys do? They come down and they knock down their jail.
Yeah.
Did you see the picture in the Oregonian newspaper? Part of the jail was stuck to the tank.
Yeah, this is why 150 people were able to escape that jail, Joe. they blew a hole in the side of the wall. I mean, they took it out.
That's right. They had tanks and helicopters, and then they probably would have brought the whole British the whole British army in there if they thought they had to.
Well, Imperius Rex here. It's the sun never sets on the British Empire, and you know why. Because everybody knows if the sun sets, then they'll reach out and steal everything you got. So you got to keep the light on them all the time. It's the old joke, the old flip side of that. Joe, thanks a lot for the call. I agree with you. This is not getting the coverage it should, and it really needs to. John in Wayland, Michigan. Hey, John, I've got about a half a minute left. What's up?
I just wondered if you heard the report about the United States burning 400,000 MREs that were sent from England.
Yes, because we're Katrina. Concerned that they have mad cow disease over there, when in fact we have it here.
Yep.
They've cleaned up their act. Yeah, it's this bureaucratic mess, and people use this as a way of saying, oh, government bad, should have been a private corporation doing that. No, I'm sorry. It's the Bush administration doesn't know how to run a government. That's what's going on. And they're going to use it to bash government. I guarantee you, John. That, you know, the Bush administration, they're screwing all these things up, and they're going out, and then they're going to go out and say, see, we told you government's no good. Well, I'm sorry. If you don't believe in government, you can't govern, and these guys can't govern. It's just that simple, and it's just that terrible. I mean, you know what they're doing. It's terrible to our government and to our reputation around the world. And we have to defeat them at the polls. It's 45 minutes past the hour.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
He's a son of a bush. When Georgie was a baby, his daddy said, son, it's your right to be richer than almost everyone. I'm giving you an oil field so you'll never fail. So Georgie pumped his way through Harvard and Yale.
Yes, welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here with He's a Son of a Bush. That's from Hail to the Thief 2, I believe. John Edwards has come out and spoken out and said some things that really need to be said in America. First, speaking about Katrina. I thought this was absolutely brilliant, and I so salute John Edwards for this. And what he's talking about fundamentally is the notion that this is not about, in any kind of a situation like this, a disaster like this, it's not about us helping them. The cons have set this thing up so with such enthusiasm, and cons like Limbaugh and whatnot, they're so into creating these divisions among us. It's really quite tragic that so many people buy into it. But it really, with poor people in the United States and the rest of us who are, you know, middle class or even wealthy, It is not, we should not be saying, oh, there's a them and an us. It's all of us, particularly with regard to Katrina. Here's John Edwards talking about Katrina and poverty.
This administration may think that every single American is an island. But
And let me just point out that this is one of the foundational principles, by the way, of conservative thought. And certainly the Ayn Rand folks are very into this. Individual responsibility, an ownership society. Which is basically those who own the most own society. And so anyhow, John Edwards.
But Americans know that Katrina's victims shouldn't have been out there on their own, and that no American should be out there on their own. That's why even when our government failed to respond to Katrina, American citizens stepped up in an extraordinary way, which all of us have seen over the last several weeks. We know that it matters how we as a nation meet our responsibilities. The truth is, it defines us as a nation.
And it's just so very, very true. And then John Edwards also said, got into talking about the social compact, about who we are as a people. And, you know, echoing in some ways Hubert Humphrey's talk about civil rights, when he said, this is not something we do for us, or this is something we do for us, for all of us. It makes us stronger. It makes us better. John Edwards' new website, the One America Committee. But anyhow, here's John Edwards talking about the social compact.
You know, words aren't enough. It's time for a new social compact in this country. When President Bush talks about an ownership society, he means the more you own, the more you get.
Yeah, and this is a really important concept because the conservatives are not at all reluctant to be quite upfront about this, to say that any time of national emergency, any time of national disaster requires a sacrifice on the part of the middle class, higher taxes for the middle class, higher taxes for average people, but no sacrifice on the part of multinational corporations or very wealthy people. No, in fact, they should see their taxes go down. None whatsoever. And it's just this is just such a key point that the Bush administration is just right up front about whose side they're on in this thing, rather than all of us being in the same boat. Back to John Edwards. We'll let him say this again and continue with his thought.
You know, words aren't enough. It's time for a new social compact in this country. When President Bush talks about an ownership society, he means the more you own, the more you get. For most Americans, his approach is the more you work, the more you pay, and the less you get.
Now, what he's talking about here is that the last Bush tax cuts said, if you earn your living sitting on your butt around the pool waiting for the mailman to show up with your dividend check, you're going to pay a maximum 15% in income tax. A maximum 15% in income tax. Whereas if you earn your living through the sweat of your brow, if you earn your living with your mind or with your body, you're going to pay up to more or less 30% in federal taxes and as much as 50% overall in taxes when you include property taxes and in sales taxes and state and local income taxes and every other kind of tax that people get hit with. And just this whole idea that you know, there's different categories of work and that those and not even categories of work, that those people whose income comes from not working at all but from investment should pay lower tax. Well, anyhow, back to John Edwards.
For most Americans, his approach is the more you work, the more you pay, and the less you get. Where I come from, what matters most is not how much you have, it's how much you give to others. Work gives pride, dignity, and hope to our lives and to our communities. And so the president is wrong. America is not and never wanted to be a wealth society.
A wealth society. This is what George W. Bush is doing, is he's extending the logic of the Reagan administration and the culture that grew up around it that celebrates greed as a positive value. Greed, in fact, is not the most positive value. There are aspects to, you know, enlightened self-interest and all that sort of thing, which you could call greed, which do have some benefit in society. But a far more powerful and important positive value is cooperation. The cells in our body cooperate with each other. When they don't, it's called cancer. Organisms in nature cooperate with each other. People in families cooperate with each other. The companies that are the most functional and successful are companies in which people cooperate with each other. Cooperation is the highest value. Shared participation, shared sacrifice. And you see this in all species, in all animals, and plants even. That balance is the basic law of nature, not dominance. What we are seeing in the conservative ideology is actually a psychopathology, a mental illness. And it began with the Reagan administration, and it has reached a crescendo with the Bush administration. Excuse me. And Americans are beginning to realize it. They're beginning to see it for what it is. And that can be nothing but a good thing, that people realize how sick it is to destroy our society so a few people can get incredibly, fabulously wealthy and the rest of us sit and got nothing.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Covers corporate lies, exposes political corruption, and has a clear vision of what America could become. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back for your minimum daily adult requirement of sanity, the Tom Hartman radio program, where we run rings around the right wing every single day. Clint Curtis is with us. His website, justaflyonthewall.com. And, Clint, you've had an interesting life working as a programmer with Yang Enterprises. You want to tell us about that?
It was interesting, no doubt about that.
First of all, who is Yang Enterprises, or what is, or what was?
Yang, well, they still are. Yang Enterprises is a computer company in Oviedo, Florida, and they had as their corporate lobbyist, their lead attorney, and their person feeding him contracts, a person by the name of Tom Feeney. He's now a congressman. At the time, he was Speaker of the House for Florida.
Now, Tom Feeney, isn't Tom Feeney the guy who came forward during the 2000 vote recount and said, as Speaker of the House of Representatives and the lead Republican in the House of Representatives in the state of Florida, that under the Constitution doesn't specify that the Electoral College representatives that are sent from a state to Washington, D.C. to vote in the Electoral College for president have to actually be elected by the people, which, by the way, was affirmed by the Supreme Court in Bush v. Gore. And therefore, the Republican majority in the House of Representatives, which he represented, he was the head of, could simply send Republican electors to Washington, D.C., even if Al Gore won the state, and therefore Bush was going to take Florida no matter what.
Correct. That's the fellow.
That's the Tom Feeney we're talking about. And this guy now is representing Florida in the United States House of Representatives.
Right.
Okay. So continue your story. Tom Feeney was a lobbyist for Yang Enterprises.
Yes. And back in 2000, I was basically the head programmer and technical advisor for the company. And that's when I first met Feeney. And he came in and asked if we could build him basically a vote rigging program, something that could flip the vote, alter the results undetectably so that you couldn't see in the source code.
Now, did you have this conversation with him personally?
Yes.
And was it private?
I was in there, Mrs. Yang was in there, and the head secretary for her secretary assistant or whatever, Mike Cohen, was in the meeting.
Okay. And Tom Feeney is asking you to build a piece of software. You're a software engineer, a programmer, and asking you to build a piece of software that can be used to flip an election and can be undetectable. Was it for a particular machine or type of computer?
Don't really know. Basically, he wanted it. His instructions were he needed it to be so it could run on a touchscreen, which means, you know, any software can run on a touchscreen because that's a matter of calibration of, you know, the inputs, as just like on a keyboard.
Right.
It just transfers it to the keyboard.
Right. Once you get outside the computer, it almost doesn't matter. You can plug any kind of screen into pretty much any kind of computer, and they recognize each other because they're standard protocols.
Correct. He wanted it so that no third-party applications had to be there. You didn't have to sit across the street and hack it or anything. You could just go up and hit some invisible keys on the screen. It would flip the vote any way you wanted to flip it. And he wanted the hard part. He wanted it to be undetectable even if you saw the source code. And I told him at the meeting, you know, you can't do that. That if it's in the source code, that's the instructions for the computer, you can see it. So, I mean, you can hide it and make it a little hard to see, but it's going to be there.
Now, we should probably let our listeners know what the difference is between source code and compiled code, right?
Okay. Source code is actually the instructions that the programmer writes that the computer is to follow. It's kind of in a human language.
Right. You can read source code, sort of. It's like, you know, I'm sorry, I interrupted you. You were going to give an example.
Well, if you know the language, you can read it. It's like reading a story. You can follow the actual logic down. Once you compile it, it converts it into a binary, and you can't read it. It's something the machine reads, and it reads it very fast, but you can't read it from a human perspective.
Right, and so the process that a programmer does is you write the program in a language, in C or in BASIC or COBOL or whatever the language is that you're working with, and it's a language where there's a lot of English language words in it, you know, if this, then this, if you see this, then do this, that kind of thing. And then when you're all done, you run that through a box, a software box called a compiler, that converts that source code into a very nice, tight little bundle of zeros and ones that is the program itself. And once it's been compiled like that, you can no longer easily see what the source code was. You can't just look at that and say, oh, this is a program to hack a vote.
Correct.
Okay. So he asked about the source code. You told him that, you know, source, as long as it's in source code, it's not going to be hard to figure out what it's all about because anybody can open it up and read it. And what was his response?
Well, Mrs. Yang then cut me off and said, we will build this program for you. You can show it to people. And that's that. And at the time, I thought, well, you know, I'm a Republican. He's a Republican. He must think that the Democrats are trying to build this, and he's trying to, you know, circumvent it.
In other words, did he say that? Did he say that he wanted you to build this vote rigging software in order to stop the Democrats from doing it? Or did you just assume that?
I just assumed that.
So you don't know. Maybe he just wanted to steal an election.
Well, later on, when I handed the code to Mrs. Yang along with the report of this is how it works and this is what you would do to stop the fraud, she came out and said, you don't understand. In order to get this contract, we have to hide the code, have to hide the fraud in the code because this is needed to control the vote in South Florida.
So that right pretty much, told you that.
Pretty much put it out there that they were looking to fix the elections.
Now, do you realize, Clint Curtis, that you're making a charge against a real person, a real company, and that, you know, to do that in public on a national radio program could subject you, if you're making this stuff up, to civil actions for libel or for slander or whatever it is. I forget which is writing and which is speaking.
Absolutely. Plus, okay. I have given this testimony in front of the Judiciary Committee in Ohio, so I swore an oath then, and since then I've also taken a polygraph test and passed that also. So it's not made up, it's very real. And
what is the response of Yang Enterprises to your allegation?
Initially they came out and said, he's a disgruntled employee.
He being you.
He being me, you just can't believe that. But I had found a card they gave me during a going away party, because they gave me a big going away party. I quit, but I didn't say, well, you're all crooks, I'm leaving. I said, I have found a better job somewhere else, I have to leave. You know, I tried to leave on nice terms, because when you're running from bad people, you really don't want to, tell them where you're going. So I was sneaking away, like the coward I am. And so they actually threw a party for me, gave me a card, signed it, you know, come back anytime. So after they came out with the disgruntled employee, I showed the card, you know, that disgruntled employees don't get going away parties.
Mm-hmm.
Especially at Yang Enterprises, where usually when an employee quits, they have security take them to the front door. So,
right. Well, it's not uncommon among all companies, frankly, for doing that. But so now they're saying what? They're just not responding to you?
Now they're not saying anything.
Yeah. And Tom Feeney, what does he say about this? Congressman from Florida, Tom Feeney, who hired you to produce for him this piece of undetectable hack-a-vote software.
Right. So far, he can no longer remember meeting me. So he's basically saying nothing, too.
It sounds like he's saying that you're making this up. If he doesn't remember meeting you, then he would... Has he asserted that you're just inventing this?
I'm not sure. I don't think he's actually commented at all.
Interesting.
I think he's refused to comment at all on it. So
is this going anywhere? Are there any lawsuits involved in this? Is there any ongoing investigation? Has anybody looked into this? Do you have any, anybody?
I don't know. I have talked to the FBI. I have, originally I talked to the Inspector General's office, but, of course, that's in Florida, which is Republican-controlled. So I don't know where it's going. I've spoken to several members of Congress. I don't have a feel for what they're doing, but basically I'm nobody, so I don't know if they tell me what they're doing, even if they're doing something.
So
they might be, and I don't know it.
Yeah, Clint Curtis. You're still a computer programmer?
Still a computer programmer.
Okay. And your website, justaflyonthewall.com, is that right?
Correct.
Okay. Clint, thanks for sharing your story with us. It's fascinating, a little chilling. And I wish you well in getting it out there. And if anybody from Yang Enterprises or Tom Feeney's office wants to share a rebuttal, they're welcome to come on this program. Clint Curtis, justaflyonthewall.com. Thanks a lot for being with us today, Clint.
Thank you for having me.
It's good talking with you. Amazing, amazing story. And Clint went before Congressman John Conyers' commission and just laid this stuff out under oath. Under oath. Tom Feeney's response? Let's talk about flag burning. Let's talk about gays in the military. It's 16 minutes past the hour.
Democracy to the United States of America. Here's Tom Hartman.
Now the people know that forests are not just scenery. My people, they want to save every green tree so they can sell it for green money to help re-elect me. I trust the people.
Yes. This is Mr. Bush's song. Welcome back, my friends. 21 minutes past the hour. Broadcasting from behind the good old working-class stainless steel microphone here in the Willamette Valley of Oregon. Tom Hartman here with you. Oh, my goodness. Clint Curtis. Tom Feeney. What is the deal? Are elections being stolen? Could it be possible? Dave in Eureka, California, what are your thoughts?
Well, you know, I was going to bounce something off of him. I definitely feel that the machines have been rigged, and the man has designed them for that purpose. So far, though, it has been exclusively a Republican thing. It was designed for the Republicans to be used by Republicans to elect Republicans. But I can't help but wonder if, like, if you had a bad Paris or somebody on there that could explain to all of us how we could do the same thing. I think that would be the one thing that would make them want to back off of it or make them verifiable is if hundreds and hundreds of Democrats learned how to invade these machines.
Yeah, and in fact, you know, Bev Harris laid this all out with Howard Dean on
Start menu, and I'm going to
show
you
national television.
And I want you to go to my computer and just click that. And you're going to see some come up, go to local disk C. Go to GEMS, which is the name of the Diebold program. You're going to go to local DB, which stands for local database. That's where they keep the votes. And by the way, this has been out on the internet for ages now. Go to Central Tabulator Votes, which is the database we just looked at, and then go to the sum of the candidates, which is that table. You see we have 800 votes here for you and 400 for Lex Luthor. Let's just flip those. We'll make that 400, and we'll give 100 votes to Tiger. Let's just see what happened here. We'll go back into GEMS the legitimate way. You're the county supervisor. You're checking on the progress of your election. And as you can see now, Howard Dean only has 500 votes. Lex Luthor has 900, and Tiger Woods has 100 votes. Mm. We just edited an election. It took us 90 seconds.
There you go. Bev Harris and Howard Dean on national TV hacking a voting machine.
See, that's what we have to learn how to do. How does one get into a voting machine? I think once we're in there, we could learn how to deal with it. But
yeah. Well, it's this raises the whole question, Dave, and you raise it very eloquently, and I appreciate the call of, you know, why do we have private for-profit corporations running our voting machines in the first place? Victoria Jones of the Talk Radio News Service on the line from Washington, D.C. Hey, Victoria.
Well, hey, Tom. It's a good question. It's one I certainly don't know the answer to.
Yeah.
But there's a great deal that I don't know the answer to in this world. But today has been quite an interesting one in Washington because, as you know, various senators had breakfast with the president to talk about the next Supreme Court nominee. We also heard that Senator Leahy is going to vote for Roberts, although we know that Harry Reid is going to vote against Roberts. So
and John Kerry has now come out and said he's going to vote against Roberts.
Right, right. So there is a very interesting split among the Democrats on this. I just attended the White House press briefing, And a little bit came up about the Supreme Court, but there were a couple of things that I thought were intriguing, one of which is actually really quite funny, which was the question of preparations for Hurricane Rita. And Scott McClellan was asked what was being done differently from how they were preparing for Hurricane Katrina. And so he replies by saying, well, the president's doing this, 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 and they're doing this, 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 and this. And so then, of course, the follow-up is, well, does that mean they didn't do that for Hurricane Katrina? And so this goes on for a long time, and he's repeatedly asked, so what are you doing anything different from Hurricane Katrina? And he keeps saying, well, I'm telling you, you know, this is what I'm telling you that we're doing different. But then, but he won't use the word different because he won't concede that there was anything that they didn't do right.
Yeah, now, was this Scotty?
Scott McClellan, yeah.
Yeah, Scotty, yeah. Yeah, well, of course, I mean, the cornerstone of this administration is never admit that you made a mistake. And if you must admit a mistake, admit it in the most general terms possible, drag everyone else along with you into it, and don't be specific.
Helen Thomas asked what seemed like a very mild question, but wasn't, because her question was simply, so is everything, you know, are all the different entities or the federal entities or all the different parts of the government in place now? You know, do you have everything in place? And, of course, if he says yes to that and then things go wrong, obviously she's got him.
Yeah. You're talking about for Hurricane Rita here now.
Right, for Hurricane Rita, exactly. Now, I asked about the rescinding the Davis-Bacon Act and cutting the wages of the people who are trying to rebuild the Gulf Coast.
And he said?
Well, it was interesting because he did two things initially to me, because he said, well, we dealt with that last week. You might want to go back and look at it. So when he does this in a very dismissive way, he's achieved two things. One is he's saying it's an old story because anything from last week apparently isn't worth talking about. And also he's implying that you don't know what you're talking about, so he's suggesting you go back and look at it.
Right.
So trying to suggest your information's wrong, which I thought was interesting. So you know, I proceeded as, you know, as best I could, but he really wouldn't even concede that it was a wage cut. And he kept saying how it was going to help minority and women businesses. And
Because they of course have to work for less pay than white males.
Exactly.
I mean, that's come on, Scotty. Does he realize what he's saying?
Well, I think he does. I don't think he does. I don't think he does.
Yeah, that's incredible. It's incredible. Okay, Victoria Jones, good on you for asking the tough questions there in the White House press conference. We can always rely on you to do it, and I'm so proud of you for standing up there with Scotty. Keep at it.
Thank you.
Okay, good talking to you, Victoria. Victoria Jones of the Talk Radio News Service. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program. The True People's Radio, 27 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Well, it's a big, big world. So much room for us all. But somehow 10% get to make the big calls. They like to stack that deck. Change the rules when they please. And while you're breaking your neck, they're on the beach in Belize.
And welcome back, my friends. 34 and a half minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. The continuing on this through story of what happened or what's going on with our voting in the United States. I got to say, the real felony against democracy in the United States, the real problem that we face, the biggest, well, not the biggest issue we confront. The biggest issue we confront really is the attack on democracy by so-called conservatives. But one dimension of that is the possibility that our vote could be tampered with. And this, which is sometimes dismissed as being in the realm of conspiracy nuts, UFOlogists, and JFK assassination researchers, I'm sorry, this is a mainstream concern. When the president of the Democratic National Committee, when the president of the DNC can go on to national television and hack a voting machine and change an election in 90 seconds in a way that's undetectable, you have a problem. You have a problem. I have a problem. We all have a problem. And that's exactly what happened. Howard Dean and Bev Harris on Topic A with Tina Brown, nationally televised program on CNBC, on live television, hacking a voting machine in real time, a Diebold machine. And now the federal government on their own website acknowledging that there's a hole in the Diebold software, that there's a back door built into the software. Now, you build in back doors for a reason. It could be in there so that you can do maintenance. It could be in there so that you can change the vote. Could be in there so you could change it. You know, why is this back door in the Diebold software? Nobody knows. The federal government on the website of the where they certify voting software is saying it's there. They're acknowledging it. Bev Harris found it, blackboxvoting.org. You can find the information, the details over blackboxvoting.org. Why? Nobody knows. And now, you know, here we have James Baker and Jimmy Carter, a tragic combination, coming out with the National Commission on Election Reform. And Senator Tom Daschle, one of the members of this commission, comes out and says their main recommendation, national voter ID, amounts to a poll tax. Their main recommendation is no good. Then you get Dan Balz in the Washington Post, B-A-L-Z in the Washington Post, saying, there's no credible evidence of partisan manipulation of the election in Ohio. Nonsense. John Conyers' commission looked into this. They published a book called What Went Wrong in Ohio. You can read it. A Diebold representative gives a $10,000 check to an Ohio election official who passes it along to the RNC. Two Ohio election officials are now indicted. Indicted. Kathleen Dreamer, manager of the board's, this is from the Cleveland Plain Dealer, from the board's ballot department, and Rosie Greer, an assistant manager, were each charged with six counts of failing to follow Ohio laws that spell out how ballots are selected and reviewed during a recount. They're facing 18 months in jail. In prison. This is the complaint first raised last December by Toledo lawyer Richard Kerger, who watched over the recount on behalf of two third-party candidates. Kerger charged that election officials failed to randomly select precincts that were supposed to be counted by hand and compared against ballots tabulated by a machine. They failed to conduct test runs before witnesses, and they failed to investigate discrepancies between vote totals. In other words, if the vote was rigged, they apparently did everything they could to make sure, well, not everything they could, they apparently did these three specific things, at least, to make sure that nobody ever knew it. Baxter, the Cleveland Plain Dealer notes, would not offer details of his investigation, but said he examined allegations that officials, quote, took measures in order to all but assure that there would not be a countywide hand count, end quote. Now you got a battle on this thing brewing and raging, or starting to rage, in California as well. Arnold Schwarzenegger wants to bring the machines in. Bring on the machines. And Kevin, was it Kevin Sheely, I believe? The former Secretary of State who the voting machine advocates got together and kicked this guy out. Well, he resigned, but as I recall. In any case, he's under considerable pressure. He's gone. Will the voting machines be back in time for 2006? Now that Schwarzenegger's numbers are in the tank, all of a sudden he has an interest in voting machines being on there. We'll see. Curtis in Sumner, Washington. Hey, Curtis, welcome to the program.
Well, thank you, Tom. It's been a real pleasure listening to you. The reason I'm calling today, I'm 53 years old, okay, and last presidential election was the first time I ever felt strong enough to vote. I know it sounds terrible, but I felt very strongly, and I decided we've got to make sure Bush doesn't get in there for another 4 years. So my wife and I, for the first time, registered and voted.
Good on you. Congratulations.
And, you know, now we feel like, was it rigged? And if so, why bother again? Was our vote even worth the effort.
Yeah, and this is, by the way, this is not the message I want people to take away from my raising these issues.
No, I want you to address it so that the people listening have a reason to go out and vote again.
Yeah. This is what I've been saying all along is, number one, we need to educate people about the fact that our elections are stealable right now, and we need to do something about it. That's the first thing that we need to talk about.
You had a guest speaker the other day, or guest on your radio, who was looking into whether or not it was, and he was a lawyer. I can't remember his name.
Right.
But are they getting anywhere? Are they going to accomplish anything so that we can say, all right, you know, there was a problem, but those people are busted. They can't do the same thing
again. The lawyer was a fellow by the name of Bob Fitrakis. He's published
right.
actually.
And I went to the website and read some stuff.
Yeah, he's published a book. I mean, he's pretty much nailed it down, in my opinion. He and I did a presentation that Friday night here in Portland at Portland State University, and he laid out all his evidence. And there's no doubt in my mind after reading or after hearing what he had to say that Bush stole the election in Ohio. But what's interesting is that most of the theft was not done by flipping voting machines. Most of the theft was done by old-fashioned methods. That Ken Blackwell in Ohio did the same thing Kathleen Harris did in Florida. That in minority communities, they withheld machines so people had to stand in line for long periods of time. They came up with a new set of rules that said if you are in the wrong precinct, then you can't vote in that precinct. And then what they did was they combined two precincts into one building, so there would be two lines going into that building, precinct 39A and 39B, for example. And if you got in the wrong line, which was a 50-50 odds that it would happen, you got in the wrong line, and you stand in that line for 5 hours, and you get all the way to the front of the line, and they say, I'm sorry, you have to be in the other line, and by the way, you have to go to the end of the other line and wait another 5 hours. There was actually one woman who tried to protest that, and they had her arrested and dragged away by the police. And that Bob actually witnessed. Whereas out in the white Republican districts, they didn't combine the precincts into buildings, and they had more than enough voting machines and ballot, places where the ballot could be taken. The challenges to the ballot, to the provisional ballots, the paper ballots, were very, intense scrutiny, different standard apparently in the African American communities and in white communities that were traditionally Democratic strongholds. It was just like a whole different set of rules. Plus, just in the year before the election, J. Kenneth Blackwell, the Secretary of State for the state, the guy who's the chief elections official for the state of Ohio, and who is also the co-chairman of the Bush for President Committee for Ohio, went through and purged tens of thousands of Democrats from the voting rolls on the basis that there's an obscure Ohio law that says that if you haven't voted in the past presidential election, in other words, if you haven't voted in the last 6 years in a national election, then even though you're a good voter, you're not a felon, blah, 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 you can still be removed from the voting rolls. And so thousands, tens of thousands of people in predominantly Democratic districts who thought that they were registered showed up for the polls, stood in line for 5 hours, got up at the front of the line, and were told, sorry, you can't vote, your name is not on the list. And that's how they stole most of the vote in Ohio. And it's John Conyers lays it all out in his book.
So what's going to change?
What's going to change is my talking about this, your talking about this, enough people spreading the word that they can't get away with this kind of stuff anymore. The Republicans had hired a company to go around. They actually were here in Oregon. They were up in Washington. They got them on tape. A TV station in Las Vegas actually got them on tape, setting up voter registration tables, little card tables, outside federal buildings, outside shopping malls, saying register to vote here. And on the registration card, you check if you want to vote in the Democratic primary, the Republican primary. Everybody who checks Democratic, they tore them up and threw them away. This could have been hundreds of thousands of people in a half a dozen states. This was a company that was hired by the Republicans, by the Republican Party itself. And this has been outed. I mean, this is like known now. It's on videotape. These kinds of things people need to get really outraged about. If the Democrats have been doing these things, you can bet everybody in America would know about it.
Oh, there'd be people in jail.
Yeah. So we need to be spreading the word.
I haven't seen it on mainstream news and so forth.
Well, it's been the stuff that I was just telling you about, for example, the company that was, throwing away the ballot, the registration forms. That actually got reported. It was a big story for like one day back before the last election. And as if it was like locally happening. And it wasn't until after the election that we discovered it was happening all over the country. But we have to speak out about these things and stay committed to the political process and stay active. Thanks, Chris.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
I call upon the world's millions. No war in our name.
And welcome back, my friends.
Stop this madness. Stop the killing. Stop the suffering and the pain.
That from the CD Hail to the Thief, Songs to Send Bush Packing, George and Julius. And Julius, 89-year-old union activist from New York City. Amazing. Welcome back to our program. Jeff in, in Denver, Colorado on the line. Hey, Jeff, what's on your mind today?
Responding to your caller who was saying, why should we, you know, I don't feel like voting anymore.
Right.
I hear that a lot. You know, remind people the quote, for evil to prevail, it is only necessary that good men do nothing. And I hate to say I get kind of angry at a lot of these people. A lot of the so-called progressives I know have finally gotten active for the first time in their life during the last election. They were active for a few months, and they didn't win, and they just want to take their toys and run home. And the thing is, there are many of us who have been active for decades, and we see that all we would need, like, say, in most states, is a few dozen very active people, and we would change the country. I mean, people, if you saw how few people it takes to get legislation, it's very minimal.
Mm-hmm.
And if you look back, you see every time the people have been organized, they won. Remember the MX missile? That was moving ahead very well. The people stopped it. The Alaska lands legislation, that was organized people. Every time the people get organized, they win. So you can't, I mean,
this is what's happened on the right, by the way. They went out and organized the churches. Ralph Reed and Jerry Falwell got together and they started organizing churches, and boom, they became a political force. And it's not because of the mass numbers of the people in who are attending the church. It's really a small number of very activist folks who believe in their cause of theocracy in America.
Yeah, and we've got to stop blaming somebody else for the problems and waiting for someone else for the solutions. It's up to us. And, I mean, I've seen things happen that are rather major. Only a dozen or so people or less have been involved.
For example?
And like voting legislation we just got through in Colorado, which I think is only mediocre. There's probably only a dozen people who really were involved in it. And if you listen to one of the things with voting we've made a big mistake on is we need to show people that it's not that we need to prove voter fraud. We need to make the people in power prove who won or who lost.
Yeah.
We need them, and it's interesting to hear in the various Secretary of State meetings we had, I heard officials say, we're only doing this because people are on our backs about it. And they're saying, now we have to prove these elections. You know, the onus is shifted to them proving it, and we need to stay on that. And it's really very easy. But, you know,
and very important.
Yeah.
Very important. And so the answer to the question, in short form, you could say, in a very real way, the answer to the question, why should I bother voting if there's a possibility my vote could be rigged, is, okay, before you vote, right now, call your Secretary of State's office or call your county clerk's office, probably more important, actually, call the county clerk's office, and say, what are you doing to make sure that when I vote in next November, a year and a month or so from now, that when I vote, that my vote is accurately and actually recorded.
Mm-hmm.
Please tell me, you know, and keep on them and call them back every couple of weeks saying, hey, you got anything new to tell me about how I know that my vote is going to be, you know, are you going to be able to actually look at the source code, at the software for the machine that's going to be counting on? Tell me when you're going to be able to. And then, and yeah, by the way,
and more importantly, can the each individual vote be recreated? Can it be done at a recount down to the vote, not down to the machine?
Right, and which requires a paper trail. And the other point is that a lot of these folks, a lot of these county commissioners, are elected themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, they're responsive to the people. And even when they're not elected, even those states where it's an appointed position, which is, I believe, very few states, they're still responsive to political pressure. So we need to be contacting them and saying, hey, what's going on? In fact, this thing that I was at last Friday night at Portland State University, Beth Hahn, one of the local voting rights activists here in Oregon, said that they actually, you know, one of their folks, I believe it was Beth who said it, it might have been somebody else, but in any case, they said that they actually showed up at the statewide meeting of county clerks, and presented their case. And a lot of these county clerks had not ever heard from anybody that they were concerned about the fact that here in Oregon we have Sequoia and ESNS machines counting our mail-in ballots. And all of a sudden, you had sensitized an entire state. So it's about it, and this was just like two or three people who showed up and spoke out. So good point, Jeff. Thank you.
Yeah, and virtually every time I hear someone complain, I said, "Have you ever talked to your city council person, your whatever representative?" So I've heard people complain for years about things, yet they've never talked to the people who are supposed to be the ones to do something about it.
Yeah, there you go. Get out and get active. Jeff, thank you very much. And at the same time, I don't think that we should be dissing somebody who just in the last election for the first time voted. I think that that's a noble and honorable thing, and I salute that. Gary in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Hey, Gary, you got about a minute left.
I know. Hi, Tom. You sound great.
Thank you.
I'd like to share, I ran across three, excuse me, I'm losing my voice, three thoughts about freedom in general.
Yes, sir.
Could I share them with you and the audience?
If they're quick.
I'll try real fast. So, by Somerset Maugham, if a nation values anything more than freedom, it will lose its freedom. And the irony of it is that if it is comfort or money that it values more, it will lose that too.
Yeah, it's a variation sort of on Ben Franklin's thing about, you know, anybody who thinks that they can have security and freedom. I think it's a great thought. I'm forgetting his quote now.
I think it's a great quote. Yeah. And one more, and I know that I got seconds. Freedom is not what a man does, nor what, this isn't mine, it's by Robert Lessing. Freedom is not what a man does, nor what he is permitted to do. Freedom is part of what a man is.
Yeah. Well, that's a good one. Thank you, Gary, for sharing
Thanks.
Those.
Thank you.
I appreciate it much. That's a step-by-step. Oop, wrong button. Step-by-step, we move forward into the 21st century. Step-by-step, we try and take this country back from the cons who have stolen our nation from us. They represent the minority of America in mainstream thought politically. They represent a corporate plutocracy. And it's not good for democracy. How do we do it? You get active. You contact your county clerk. You show up for Democratic Party meetings or Republican Party meetings for that matter. Get active. Get out there and participate. We'll see you tomorrow.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.